This is the Energy Exchange, conversations about how energy connects to the economy, national security, and sustainability, helping you to understand a changing world. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jan Mueller. On today's show, whatever happened to peak oil? The assertion that the rate at which oil is extracted from the earth is nearing a maximum or peak level. With falling oil and gasoline prices and a boom of new oil development in the United States, concern about global oil supplies have faded from public view. But have concerns about peak oil really disappeared? What key factors have changed in the oil industry, and what challenges remain? Are we entering a new era of abundance, or are the risks of the world's dependence on oil still present as ever, or even rising? We'll examine these and other key questions regarding the global outlook for oil and what it means for the future. And with me to address these and other questions, we have three outstanding guests that I'm really pleased to have together on today's show. Jeremy Gilbert is a former chief petroleum engineer for BP, now principal with Barrymore Limited, based in Ireland. John Kingston is the president of the McGraw-Hill Financial Institute and the former news director for Platts, the energy division of McGraw-Hill, in New York. And in Colorado, Steve Andrews, the co-founder of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil USA and a former energy consultant. Gentlemen, welcome to today's show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us here.
Steve, if I could, I'd like to start with you and just talk about how the world has changed and how the oil industry has changed since the first Association for the Study of Peak Oil conferences were organized in Europe in 2000 and later in the United States in 2005. And what elements of the original peak thesis are true and which may need a little bit of revision or a lot of revision?
Sure. Thanks, Jan. I would say that the broad thesis of peak oil, which is that there's, when you produce a finite resource, eventually you'll hit a maximum level of production and it'll thereafter decline gradually or steeply, who knows. The broad thesis still is true. The first ASPO conference in Europe was in 2002 and the first one in the U.S. was in 2005. Since that time, the biggest single change, there are probably two major changes. One is that in the Middle East, a lot of violence and change is afoot, which keeps supply, the sense of long-term supply, a bit tenuous. But the supply has more or less continued. There have been events in Libya and so on which have interrupted large chunks, but the world has moved forward during the last decade. The biggest single change over the last 10 years is the boom in North America, particularly in the United States. And this is the biggest growth in oil production in the history of the U.S. over a three-year period. It's been a staggering achievement by the industry. I have to admit that the peak oil camp underestimated the ability of both technology and the industry to make this achievement. The thinking was that when we move from conventional oil to unconventional oil, that it would not only be more expensive, which it is, and that it would not only have perhaps a larger environmental footprint, which it does, but that the product would be slower to flow to the market, which turned out to not only not be true, but to be the opposite. We've had the fastest increase, as I say. But I would describe this as a very pleasant interlude on the upside for the U.S. economy in particular, and it's helped maintain slight growth in world oil production. If you took out North America over the last the growth in North American oil production over the last decade, it's been flat to slightly down. So peak oil is still, as a broader concept, is very much alive, but we've had, as I say, an interlude, a surprising interlude, that has now led to very low prices and rapid change in the oil industry.
Steve, thanks very much. John Kingston, you know, you were in the news business and in the information business, and you watched all this unfold both when no one was anticipating the shale revolution in the United States or anywhere else, and people were talking about supply constraints, and the world has changed very rapidly. How did things look at from your perspective?
Well, it's true that I actually went as a reporter to two ASPO conferences, I believe, one in Denver and one in Houston. And it was when shale was just kind of starting, and I remember hearing the late Matt Simmons, who was, you know, probably easily the best known peak oil advocate, you know, just completely dismissing this as being insignificant. And obviously, Matt turned out to be wrong. When I went, it was like 2006, 2007, and in fact, you know, the numbers were pretty scary back then. Level of production had basically flatlined through most of the world, and demand was rising, particularly in China. And it's all resulted in this surge that hit its own peak at about $147 oil in early July 2008. And then two things happened: the world economy collapsed with the whole Lehman Brothers Wall Street crisis, and then you started to have the upturn in the U.S. at the same time. So you know, in the perspective of 2006-2007, it did look pretty scary, and the peak oil crew seemed to be onto something. I will say one thing: that what I learned from the meetings is that you can divide the peak oil camp into something that somebody that Steve Andrews knows, a guy named Steve Kovitz, one time described as the suits and the sandals. And somebody like Steve would be the suits because they've got a geology background and they understand the industry. And then the sandals would be, you know, people just hate the oil industry, period. And as a result, you know, peak oil became something they could really latch on to for their arguments. But I would say this, that the history of all commodity markets has been cycles. The history of commodity markets has been predictions of relatively imminent resource exhaustion that never seemed to come. And the reason is that the market sends out signals to substitute demand, to reduce demand. It sends out signals to work harder and work more creatively to find new ways of supply. And that always tends to break the back of a surging commodity price, whether it's oil or some other commodity. Now, I will say this, that the period leading up to 2008, as I mentioned, was a little scary, and the shale oil breakthrough is so transformative that it's almost hard to say that that's part of the normal flow of things. Though, quite frankly, maybe, you know, the price of oil sticking around $100 for all that time incentivized the people at Continental and Barrett, et cetera, and Devon, who led to these changes. I know what Steve is saying, that this is an interlude. I don't know that I agree with that, but I would say this, that you know, the most optimistic forecasters are that the shale revolution in the U.S. will be exported somewhere else, and that will give us plenty of supply. I would say that what's happening in the U.S. happened in part because of the rights of private property holders to share in the fruits of the labor and the fruits of the flows, and you don't see that at other places, and that may slow it. And you know, you've just got a more dynamic economy, the more creative economy that found ways to figure this out. And I just don't know if you've got that elsewhere. So I think that we're not in an interlude. If you can export this revolution elsewhere, I don't know that it's going to be that easy to do.
Okay, that's helpful. And I think we'll get more into the prospects for the shale revolution outside of the United States. And as you and Steve alluded to, this is usually seen as a black and white, two different sides. Peak oil is or isn't happening, or if it is happening, it's happening way in the future. But the truth is always usually in the middle. And Jeremy Gilbert, from all your years with BP and seeing how these projects actually play out, and you know, what's your perspective on how the two sides see things, and where people were maybe trying to articulate some common ground?
Well, the first thing you asked me, Jan, was to talk about what's changed in the world since the first peak oil conferences. Physics, basic reservoir physics, doesn't change. We understand pretty well when we find We make an oil discovery. We understand pretty well how that oil is going to behave when we drill wells into the reservoir and deplete the pressure there. The physics hasn't changed. Just in the same way as we, as Steve articulated a few minutes ago, if you have a finite resource and you produce from it, ultimately it has to run out. But that was the case, we argued, in 2002. We're still arguing it now. The U.S. shale oil will follow exactly the same process. There's a certain amount of oil in the ground. It's very difficult to recover it. We will recover some of it. We'll reach a peak, and the shale oil production will decline. I mean, this is very, very basic physics, and nothing basic physics doesn't change. Some things, of course, have changed since 2002. We've discovered resources that we didn't, of a size that we didn't anticipate, certainly in terms of U.S. tight oil. So the various depletion curves that people drew and the estimates they made do have to be adjusted. But the basic principle hasn't changed. There's a finite resource there. A certain amount of it we can recover. The higher the price we're prepared to pay for it, the more we can recover. That's something maybe that we didn't emphasize sufficiently in the early days of the ASPO talks. Reserves are a function of both the size of the resource and price and the technology, but technology and price are very closely related. So as technology develops, if we're prepared to pay to apply that technology, which means higher oil prices, then reserves may, for a brief time, grow, but eventually will be depleted, and the peak oil message remains the same. The time when we get onto the decline curve may move forward a little bit. The shape of the decline curve may change a little bit because of technology and what we're prepared to pay, but decline we will have.
And I guess we are seeing it in many fields. At the same time, we're seeing increases in other fields. And I guess it's a question of, you know, who's the increase in one place, is it enough to compensate?
Well, we only see increases in fields that are already on production. We only see increases in production rate or increases in reserves if we do something new, if we apply some form of secondary or tertiary recovery. In very few cases, once the field has been put on production and once we understand the nature of that field, in very few cases do we see production rates from that field increase. Once we've developed a field, once we've invested in production facilities for a field, we may prolong the life of that field, but it's pretty unusual to see any dramatic change, increase in production offtake.
Okay.
I guess the offshore fields from the UK would be pretty good examples of that, where over time there's been reworking and small fields added on where as big fields have dried up, but by and large, the UK's production is down, 60%, two-thirds, something like that over the course, since about 2000, 1999, when it peaked. And there's been a lot of nice technology that's been added since then, developed and brought to the Gulf of Mexico
and we've been able to do that, Steve, because of high prices. If prices hadn't been high, that technology would not have been applied.
Right.
The actual reserves would not have been achieved.
And the sort of don't worry about it school kind of agrees with that. It is that at a certain point, if your production of any commodity, it's not just oil, of any commodity is declining, the price of it will rise enough to incentivize new technologies, to incentivize moving those technologies to places other than they have been found. Now, let me just, I don't want to be too free market about this because, you know, one when they teach Econ 101, one thing that they do teach you is that a government can step in and screw this all up. And so, you know, when you look at the, when you look around the world right now, the fact is that there are so many companies, so many countries that are underproducing what they should be producing as a result of mismanagement. I would certainly put Venezuela at the top of the list. And then you've got Nigeria there, and you've got Iran in there just because of sanctions, but probably also because of a not particularly well-run industry. So, you know, if you look at the world capacity right now, and then you took let's say you assume that, you know, peace broke out in the world and every government ran its industry efficient, the spare capacity in this world would be enormous. Of course, had that all been done, had all these countries operated the way they should have been, well, the price might have been low, and you might not ever have incentivized the whole shale revolution. So, you know, but the actions of government here cannot be downplayed, because they can take a country with tremendous reserves and do it and use them for the public good, like Norway or the UK, North Sea was just mentioned, or you can use it just to essentially ruin the place, like Nigeria or Venezuela.
Yeah, but I think those are sort of side effects, in a sense, John, because we still get back to the point there's only so much hydrocarbon in below the Earth's surface. And we may be efficient at recovering that hydrocarbon, and we may be inefficient. But the fact remains, there's only a certain amount there, and there's only a certain amount that we can recover. So the peak oil message that we're dealing with a declining resource, a resource which is getting smaller and smaller, the peak oil message has not changed.
But couldn't you have applied that message from the time of Colonel Drake's well? I mean, the resource is always finite. The resource always was declining, and there have been multiple forecasts of, you know, we're running out, we're at our peak production, and it did look like that was happening a couple of years ago, and lo and behold, there's another breakthrough. And so this is a message that has been around a long time, and the creativity of this industry never ceases to amaze. And, of course, then demand to adjust to the price and adjust to the supply that's out there.
Well, there's certainly, yeah. John, there's certainly interactions that go on there. When price got up as high as it did, we saw, particularly in the OECD countries, we saw demand start to flag, in fact, drop. And it's been dropping gradually since about 2006, 2005, 2007. Prices were always a little higher there, but we hit a price point there given the demand in the developing countries, the developed countries decided that efficiency and, well, just consumption couldn't be sustained at that level, at least not for them. So they also switched over to efficiency a little bit, but it's been pretty slow and pretty gradual. And as you can see in the United States right now, demand at a low price is bouncing back, so some of those efficiency gains were really the economy slowing down dramatically and not bouncing back as perhaps as much as some of the public figures would indicate. I would say that yes, demand has responded somewhat, but it's been painful to people. It's not like there's a simple substitute when the price went up. Mostly, for a good while, the response was we're going to drive less, which is not something that most people would choose, but that's been the result, or was the result until the price drop of that started last fall.
You know, back to the issue of government, one thing about this low price environment that's been actually very beneficial on the demand side long term is that, you know, if you look at the data like in 2007, the only countries in the world pretty much that had increases in demand that year when the price was very high on its way to its record were countries that had subsidized oil consumption in one way or another. And, you know, it would have been very painful to take those subsidies off of the population at that point, even though the price of the subsidies was just killing these governments. And one thing that's happened in a lot of places around the world, not every place, but a lot of places over the last several months, is that with the low prices, you can take off some of these subsidies, and it isn't quite the doesn't result in quite the hysteria that it might have several years ago. So one thing when you look forward is that, you know, those subsidized prices kept demand higher than it should have been in the past. If, you know, the price starts to spike up, you're not going to have those subsidies, and that's actually good because it allows the market to respond better to the higher prices.
Yeah, but a lot of the countries like Indonesia, Egypt, and so on, where these subsidies are being cut, are countries where most of the hydrocarbon that's consumed is consumed by people low down on the social scale. It's not by people driving around in big BMWs and Mercedes. It's being consumed by small farmers running pumps. It's being consumed by fishermen with small outboard engines. I don't think I don't think price really affects their usage levels particularly. If you've got to irrigate a field, you're going to run your pump. You'll have less money at the end of the year when prices are high, but your consumption is unlikely to change very much because price changes.
Gentlemen,
it's not the same as in Western Europe or in the U.S.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. We're talking about the idea of peak oil, where it's been, and how it applies to what we're seeing in the oil industry today. And with me are Jeremy Gilbert, former chief petroleum engineer for BP, John Kingston, president of the McGraw-Hill Financial Institute and former news director for Platts, the energy division of McGraw-Hill, and Steve Andrews, co-founder of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. Earlier, we were talking about the importance of price, and that's the way that most of the world, the consuming public, understands oil in terms of cost. But companies, incur costs directly, and apparently the capital expenditures of several major oil companies are getting squeezed by rising costs, and even when prices were up at $100, and now they've dropped precipitously, and we see projects being reevaluated. So, what do we know about costs, and is in fact the price of getting oil out of the ground in the United States or around the world going up? Has the shale revolution driven costs down, or is that a more intensive and more expensive proposition? Jeremy Gilbert, what do we know about costs and intensity?
Well, I guess what we know about costs is that over the last decade or so, with the pretty high prices that we've seen during much of that time, costs have essentially got out of control. The oil industry is a mixture of all sorts of companies, from the oil producers themselves to drilling contractors to completion companies. I mean, it's a jungle. And there's little doubt, I think, that a lot of companies have made a lot of money while being pretty inefficient over the last decade or so. I think what we're going to see if this Saudi-led low-price regime lasts for more than a year, 18 months, we're going to see a new tsunami of efficiency come across the industry. Already we're seeing contractors in all sorts of disciplines reducing costs by 20, 25, 30% in response to what's happened over the last 6 months. I think we'll continue to see that happen. I think costs are going to be driven down. I think companies are going to become more efficient. They're going to have to be more efficient to survive. So it may well be that if oil prices over the next 4 or 5 years struggle up to $80-$90 a barrel, we get back into a position where companies are making lots of money with those oil prices. We're going to put efficiency in a big way across the industry, and that will be a good thing. And this has happened after other price decreases in the past. The companies have become more efficient. The oil industry is notorious. Development projects miss targets. They come in late. They don't deliver the production they hope they deliver. This is a big chance for the industry to make itself more efficient, and companies that don't make themselves more efficient will go. We're starting to see this in the North Sea, for instance. We're starting to see old fields, small companies, just get out of the business. They're not profitable anymore. They're beyond redemption. But the companies that can redeem themselves, I think, will have a bright future in front of them, even at low oil prices.
John Kingston, Jeremy talked about companies, either getting more efficient or getting out of the industry. Maybe individual investors in the financial world don't care about who's, they just worry about where the market's going overall, and that there's somewhere they can make some money. What's the perspective from in New York there?
Well, no, I mean, if they cared about was making money, then basically every company would have the same valuation. They absolutely care about the management of certain companies, and they know that certain companies are well run, and certain companies are maybe not as well run. And what is the debt position? What is the balance sheet? You know, clearly there's a lot of companies out there right now that are overloaded with debt. They've had very cheap capital now for several years and have enabled them to grow and to produce. And this is one of the reasons why you've had this, this great growth in supply, because capital has been so cheap. What kind of strikes me about the shale business a little bit is it reminds me a little bit about of the railroad industry in the late 1800s, when there were lots and lots and lots of railroads and they were all levered up and a lot of them went bust. And as a result of that, some of the bigger, more well-situated companies with deeper pockets took them over. And so their infrastructure was still in place. And, the country was able to benefit from then, and quite frankly, is still benefiting from it now. And I would imagine that the infrastructure, and the infrastructure isn't necessarily just roads and other facilities, but just the whole level of knowledge that has been built up over the past few years, it'll probably get sucked up by bigger companies with deeper pockets, buying up companies that have overextended themselves. And as a result of that, you're going to continue to have this infrastructure that's been developed put to use to produce oil or gas or whatever.
But then what about the notion, though, that collectively in the aggregate we might get a point where there's no more profitable projects or at the prevailing price?
Well, then this is no more. This is exactly what we were talking about before. There's no more projects at the current price, and the price then that'll affect supply. The price will go up, and some of these projects will then become economical. This has been the ebb and flow of commodity markets forever. That's why I never get too worried, except when government can screw it up.
Okay, well,
yeah, the one thing that's different about oil, of course, John, is it's not pork bellies. It's not maize. It's not cotton. There is only a finite amount of this substance in the Earth's crust, and you can do what you like with the price, but you can't alter that fact. All you can do by changing price is change the efficiency with which we extract from that resource. So we can change the recovery efficiency from the resource, but the resource is there. The resource is of a certain size, and it's not affected by price. It's the amount of oil that's there below the Earth's crust. All the oil price changes is efficiency.
Well, I think we're in agreement there. I mean, I know that the amount of oil there is precise, and I think already we're setting ourselves up for probably the next big cycle, because what's happened is, as a result of the collapse in price, which I think everybody thinks is going to kind of stick around for a while, what you're going to have is eventually you'll have a reduced rig count, you'll have a rise in demand, the price will rise to once again justify some work that maybe wasn't justified before, and so that sets up the next cycle. Now, what I would say is this, that Steve earlier talked about this interlude. You know, shale can come back on pretty quickly. Unlike when we've had cycles in the past when the price got low and then the price rebounded and you had your more conventional wells, you know, they were slower to come back. You can turn shale on very rapidly, and you can drill rapidly, and it produces rapidly. I mean, this is kind of one of the peak oil criticisms of shale, is that it runs out fast. It does, but at the same time, once you stick those drill bits down there, you get supply rapidly and you get it fast. So this is, I think, the dilemma.
Well,
But
shale oil is a finite resource as well. So yes, for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, maybe what you say is correct. But there's still going to come a point when the shale oil resource is essentially depleted. So we may have postponed the point where we can be confident that we've reached a peak, but we haven't we haven't removed that point from the future. It's still there.
Right, I agree. I will say this. I think that the one big unknown out there is how well the shale revolution gets exported to other countries. So far, the record isn't too good. There was a lot of hope in Poland. Of course, that was more gas than oil. China so far has mostly been unsuccessful. The reports out of Argentina have been fairly optimistic. But I would say that you say 15, 20 years. That actually is a pretty long time. I think that could be extended if you can export the shale revolution to other countries, and that at this point is not certain. The role of private property and private mineral rights, private ownership of the mineral rights, has been a very big factor in the U.S., and you don't have that elsewhere. That's why I'm a little hesitant that you can easily take the revolution here and move it somewhere else.
Well, it's not just mineral rights. It's also logistics. It's also the fact that in the U.S. you have a long-established network of pipelines, processing plants of various kinds, mostly an open country, which you don't have in Western Europe, which you don't have in a lot of parts of the Far East. So the conditions, I think, are quite different. And the shales themselves, of course, are geologically quite different. Their position vertically below the Earth's surface is different. The quality of the shale is different. I don't think you're going to see, or we're going to see, a rapid export of shale oil technology and production from the U.S. to the rest of the world. It'll happen, but it'll happen slowly. And the rate at which it adds to world oil supply, I think, is unlikely to have much effect when we take into account production decline from more conventional resources.
Jan, I've got a comment I'll add about cost, too. It's interesting that the majors, the oil majors, 1 year ago were announcing belt tightening and capital expenditure discipline regimes that were changing while prices were still high. The reason for that is that even the efficiencies that Jeremy talked about hadn't arrived yet. They have now to some degree. But so a year ago, you had Shell and others announcing some belt tightening on some of their projects, and that was indicated that down the road discoveries were going to drop a little bit, new field finds were going to drop a little bit, and in fact last year was the lowest discovery rate in a number of years at the by the majors. So you have that going on at the very same prior to the oil price cut started in the fall of last year. So you have shale oil ramping down, and you have a much slower response among the majors in their big projects, the ones that take 6 and 8 years lead time. You have those two factors that I think will come home to roost a bit down the road a piece. I agree with John that it can be, that shale oil can be ramped up, though I question how fast. When it took a while to build up to the number of rigs that we had, it's not like you can flick the switch on a power plant, on a gas-fired power plant versus a coal-fired power plant. I mean, that's sort of the analogy. A coal plant is slow to come back. A gas-fired power plant is like almost like flicking a switch or turning the dial on a stove. It will be faster, but the one thing that happens when you have a slowdown in drilling is that eventually it then gets harder to maintain, given the very high decline rates from those shale oil wells. If you have a little dip in the rate of production, you then have to drill your first wells, just bring you back up to the plateau that you were on, and the next bit of drilling perhaps may resume the increase, the very impressive increase that we've seen over the last 3 years. But eventually the math is going to come home to roost there too, and it isn't just costs. There are two factors. One, we're drilling all the sweet spots in these fields, and so at the same cost, you're getting more oil. As we move out from those, there are four counties in the Bakken that are really the big producers, and everything else are the also-rans. As you move outside of those areas, for the very same cost, you're going to get less oil. Or even for lower costs, as the industry gets more efficient, you're still going to get less oil. And that will mean that it will be difficult to sustain anything close to the growth rates that we've seen. You know, in my opinion, the growth rate that we saw over the last 3 years, again, the record, all-time record for U.S. oil increases in U.S. oil production, I don't believe that'll be can be resumed because we've gotten closer to the point where it gets harder and harder to maintain that very same rate of growth. Much harder. You have to drill more productive wells. Perhaps you have to change your spacing to be optimized. You have to extract more oil through efficiencies and technology. All of that's going to have to come to play just to keep some rate of growth in U.S. oil production from the shale fields. And, you know, I didn't think there was more than a year or two, maybe 2 years, of run on that, on that incline. I think given this oil price cut, that probably is over for a while. And we could be on a bumpy plateau with perhaps slight increases and slight declines over the course of the next 3 years.
So I'm tempted to use the blind men feeling around the elephant analogy and just say you can look at the either a project or the overall situation through a demand lens, a supply lens, a cost lens, or a price lens. You can say that the shale resource runs out, or you can say that it gets too expensive. And I guess whatever rate it comes out, however quick we ramp it up, or the efficiency with which we can recover from a given resource, it still seems like it's going to come down to cost. So is shale, and we're talking about the majors and their capital expenditures. I don't know if it's all been from shale. That there's been other deep water projects and whatnot that that are just harder and harder. They just cost more to their overall logistics. So how much of the attractively cost oil do we have, and how much are we having to lean on this stuff that's really right up there around the break point or beyond the break even point in terms of price?
I'm not totally sure I understand the question, but I will say that there have been deep water projects that have come online. At the same time, there have been normal declines in the more mature deep water fields. I did see a number that I thought somebody estimated that you could probably account for 90% of the growth in U.S. supply to have come from shale when you balance it all out. I don't know what you guys would think about that, but that's one thing I had read.
Well, the majors have projects. I think some of their projects are not. A lot of their projects are not necessarily in the United States, or I may be wrong about that. But I guess I'm trying to understand if the capital expenditure of the majors going up is due to shale or other factors.
Well, the capital expenditure of the majors isn't going up; it's coming down, Jan. They've all announced cutbacks. 10-20% cutbacks for this year and the coming year. So projects outside the shale oil industry certainly are being cut back very severely. They're being cut back, they're being delayed, and that will continue.
And the really long-term projects that are already underway, many of them, if not most of them, will continue. The Chevron's Gorgon project off of the east coast of Australia, west coast, and so on. Some of these projects are coming close to fruition, and some of the Gulf of Mexico projects will continue as well. And so you'll have a surge of these projects from the majors that will continue to come on, but not a surge, but a steady flow. But you can already expect and anticipate that a number of years out, that will slow a bit, just due to this current price drop and the cutbacks that Jeremy referred to. The 15-20% capital expenditure, 15-30% that the majors have announced will result in some new projects being postponed.
Absolutely, and it's a cutback in exploration as well. Exploration drilling is being slowed. So you're going to see over the next 10, 12 years, you're going to see projects come on stream much later than they might have if prices had remained high. There's a very clear connection between what companies expect to be getting price-wise for their oil in 12 years' time, 15 years' time, and the exploration effort they're going to make now. Projects run for a long time. There's a big gap between discovery and production. Production lives can be 15, 20 years. People are predicting, making oil price predictions into the very, very deep future and deciding that they haven't got the confidence in high prices that's necessary to push ahead with expensive exploration. If you're going to drill an exploration well for $200 million, $250 million, you want to be pretty confident that not just that you're going to find oil, but that you're going to get a decent price for that oil in 12, 15 years' time. And if you don't feel that, you're not going to drill the well.
Jan, maybe when you talked about cost, I think you were, or price, you were referring to the economy and consumers. I'd point out a fellow named Stephen Coppetz, whom you know, and I think all of the people on the line probably know. You know, he said that effectively in the $100 range, we were already pushing beyond the sustainable, the price that our economy can sustain, and not just the U.S., but at the world level. If the price was $100, we weren't able to sustain that. Of course, we were bailed out, if you will, from $147 oil and the consequences there because of the financial system collapse, which may have, to some degree, have been exacerbated by that huge price spike in oil. We actually had, to the consumer, we had a surprisingly stable price of oil from 2011 through late sometime in 2011 through the middle of 2014, or late 2014. And we were, you might say we were getting used to it, but frankly, consumption was slowly, in the developed country, was slowly declining, even as it was continuing elsewhere. Growth was continuing elsewhere, but I don't know how much the economic impacts of the price of oil was impacting China, but I will say that based on what's happening in China to the economy at large, their consumption of oil, their rate of growth in the consumption of oil has slowed dramatically, and so that may impact cost as well. I mean, that's a contributor to the drop in the price, which has benefited U.S. consumers, but because of economic conditions it hadn't really helped the Chinese, hasn't really helped in India, hasn't really helped the Europeans to the degree that has helped us.
We'll also remember something. Those other countries, a lot of them have suffered from weakness against the dollar. And since this is all priced in dollars, if the price of oil goes down 10%, but the value of their currency goes down 5% against the dollar, then they only get a 5% benefit. So that's one of the reasons why the U.S. is really enjoying this more so than most other countries.
Right.
Gentlemen, that's a great way to set up our final segment where we'll take a big picture look at how really the larger economy affects the oil industry and how the oil industry affects the economy. We'll be back after a short break. And we're back talking about oil demand, supply, price, cost with Jeremy Gilbert, former chief petroleum engineer of BP, John Kingston, president of McGraw-Hill Financial Institute, and Steve Andrews, co-founder of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil USA. And Steve, before the break, you were talking about how some people talking about that the economy can't bear a certain price of oil. So let's talk about how demand factors into this equation. You know, ultimately, whatever, how much there is in the ground or what it costs to get out of it, it's what people are willing to pay. Would you elaborate on that?
Sure. John already made a really good point, and that is that once the price came down far enough, some of the developing countries that were subsidizing oil are removing those subsidies. As they do that, demand in those countries will actually soften, because in some cases it means an actual price increase to the consumer. So in some of the developing countries where there were subsidies, we might see consumption level off or perhaps even decline. That's one point. On the other extreme, it's in the U.S. where the taxes, despite what people think, taxes on oil consumption are relatively low. So when we see the price of oil decline at the wellhead or from the supplier to the gas station, when that declines, we tend to respond in two ways. One, we drive more miles, and two, we buy bigger vehicles. And that both of those things are happening. We're back. Recent numbers indicate that consumption or vehicle miles traveled in the U.S. are back up at about record levels for this time of year, and those records were set back in 2007. So consumption is snapping back in this country in response to a decline in price. But there's also the broader economy, and the broader economy in places like China and Europe in particular, those two areas, the broader economy has softened enough that the U.S. dollar has changed enough that they're not seeing their consumption remains somewhat flat. It's not bouncing back the way ours is.
Yeah, the January miles traveled figure, back to your earlier point, was apparently 5% year on year, which is an enormous number.
Yeah, that's an increase all the way back to about 2007, and that means that if we see cheap, it's the only price that we see every day when we drive around. It's the only price for any good that we see every day. So it has an impact on our national psyche. It's above and beyond the price of any other good, be it jeans, cigarettes, pop, cars, you name it. It's the price we respond to, I think, and subliminally, if you will, I think our well-being is somewhat impacted by the price we see at the gas station when we drive by.
It seems like as you're saying, when oil prices are relatively low and consumers are happy, no one's talking about oil's effect on the economy, and yet when they start to go up, it seems like every financial program or any news program is saying, you know, we expect this to dampen economic activity and economic growth. So, John Kingston, what is your sense of the consensus or level of understanding about that and about how important oil prices are to the aggregate economy?
Well, they're obviously in the U.S. I mean, for all the gains in U.S. net import dependence, the U.S. is still net import dependent about 4.5 to 5 million barrels a day. So obviously, it's good for the economy. But you can understand why, in the short term, if you start to get a collapse in prices, why it might, let's say, affect the stock market negatively, because you're going to get layoffs, you're going to get reduced activity out in the fields, whereas the impact on the broader economy is a little more diffuse and harder to measure. So it is kind of strange. You would think that there'd be almost this direct correlation between the decline in the price of oil and the broader equity markets. But it's understandable why in the short run it might have a hit on those markets, and the benefit would come down the road. The U.S. is still a pretty big oil producer. It's a pretty large industry. But all in all, for the U.S., this is enormously beneficial. And, some of the sectors that don't get quite the notice that they should, with cheap natural gas, we've been talking just about oil, but oil is a global market, so everything tends to balance to a certain degree. Natural gas is more of a stranded market here in the U.S. because you can, LNG exports have only been allowed, been permitted over the last year, and they haven't even started yet. So the U.S. has benefited greatly from that. Industries like petrochemicals are growing in the U.S. Industries, small ones, I always like to cite the direct reduced iron industry. It's a really tiny industry. It's a steel making feedstock, but it's always fascinating to me because Before I worked at Platts, I worked for American Metal Market, and in my early education, I learned that, in fact, the nation's DRI industry had all gone offshore because of the high price of natural gas, mostly to Trinidad, which really had stranded gas, and now, in fact, it's coming back to the U.S. because the U.S. has such cheap gas. So it's overall benefit, but that doesn't mean it's a straight-line benefit. There's going to be some rocky times and certainly some rocky industries.
I didn't mention earlier in the program where each of you are based, and Jeremy Gilbert, you're based in Ireland most of the time, and you did a lot of your work, I think some of it in the UK. I guess I'm wondering if you have some advice for an oil-producing country going through an oil boom on how to plan your economy around both the upside of that boom as well as the downside.
Well, I think if I was giving that sort of advice, I'd be giving it about 20 years too late to most places. But, there are lots of examples around of countries that have managed their oil industries extremely well. I mean, the Norwegians, I guess, would be the prime example. And you could probably add to that the Kuwaitis, the UAE. A lot of countries have developed their industry. They've made certain that a significant proportion of the money flowing in to the industry has been extracted by the state and has been wisely invested. So there are lots of countries that are good examples, and then of course there are many, many countries where there are extremely bad examples, where the state has not been incorrupt enough and far-thinking enough to be able to follow the Norwegian example. And of course I suppose the prime example is Nigeria, a country which it would seem should have been able to set itself up for the next century financially if it had done things properly, but instead blatant corruption and short-sightedness has led to exactly the opposite situation. So I think if you were the sort of country you questioned me about, there are lots of good examples, but there are an awful lot of incompetent, corrupt politicians around who make it unlikely the good examples will be followed.
Well, I've
got a quick point about the UK. When we let the markets work sometimes, and you look back historically, you go, wish we'd have done things a little differently. In the UK, during the 80s and 90s, they were exporting oil when it was in the $20 range. For the last few years, they've been importing oil in the $100 range. So that was a case of sell low and buy high that has really hammered the UK as far as I can see. So, free markets will lead you to that. And that's not a government policy. That's an absence of policy that in the rearview mirror looks unfortunate. But I don't know how it could have been avoided. I would just say that, yes, the Norwegian example is terrific, but we're looking at a country of 6 or 8 million people compared to many of the other countries that are exporting, and they're a very wealthy country compared to, obviously, some of the nations, particularly Nigeria, that Jeremy mentioned.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Steve. I think that the UK example is one that emerging countries should look at. I mean, the UK was broke in the late 70s, early 80s as a state, and the arrival of the oil industry was saved the country from all sorts of economic problems. So there was tremendous pressure from government on the companies that were operating in the North Sea in the early 80s, because I was there at the time. Tremendous pressure from the government to get fields on production and to produce them at very high depletion rates. So, yeah, that's an example of short-termism. The country was broke, it needed money, so encouraging the oil industry to deplete these fields very quickly solved a short-term problem, but it certainly left a long-term one.
So I'd like to get back to our opening question about whether, in general, if we're at the verge of a new era of abundance, or are the risks of the world's oil dependence, which we've always been concerned about, but there's this hope that they're easing, but they may in fact be just ever as present as ever, and maybe even increasing. And if we're talking off during the break, we talked about, you know, ultimately there is a need to think long term and have a transition, and what you do when you're when the oil is flowing at affordable rates is you shouldn't forget that reality will change, you know, whether it changes for the better or for the worse. So we're talking about prudent planning and at least hedging our bets, if not a deliberate transition. So I would invite your thoughts on that. John Kingston, would you start us off?
You know, I don't want to be too cynical or skeptical, but I would say it gets difficult to make significant investments in other technologies, in efficiency technologies, when the price is so low. The incentive is to spend that money elsewhere. And this really is ultimately one of the factors in the never-ending coming and going of commodity cycles. The price gets low, investment dollars stop, or they won't stop, but they certainly reduce, consumption rises, and then you rise yourself up to another crisis point, and then demand collapses, and you start to incentivize new technologies to produce the commodity, and then and so it goes on and on. So, you know, the what are the great opportunities here at a low price? You know, it's kind of hard to see because, as I said, I do think that there has been a significant opportunity that has been taken by a lot of countries in eliminating their subsidies. But, you know, at these prices, everybody's kind of hanging on for dear life. And if you're going to look to have some kind of, let's say, government-sponsored program to fund alternative technologies, you know, inevitably those get caught up in politics. You know, I think back to George Bush promoting hydrogen, 10 years ago. Well, you know what? Had those hydrogen research facilities actually gone into effect, they'd probably still be open, even though they may not be needed anymore. So I hate to be so cynical, but this is just a time when I think the world will enjoy these prices and not invest in the sector, and it'll set us up for the next, I don't want to call it crisis, but the next price elevation.
I've learned that you should never make predictions about anything, especially when it comes to the oil industry. But we are, you know, the timing seems to be a critical question about how much time, how fast do we need to be making deliberate transitions other than allowing for just market forces to do their thing. So, you know, with the premise that a deliberate transition of some sort, whether it's broad policy or specific investments on the ground, Steve Andrews, what are your thoughts on that, from what you've seen and other people you've talked to?
So I'm going to come at the answer here from two points. I'll get to the transition part, but I made a point a little earlier that offline that Roscoe Bartlett, a former U.S. congressman, made, which is the higher you climb up the production and therefore consumption ladder, the farther you have potentially to fall or to come down, and the more painful it can be making a transition, because the scale of consumption of this resource is so large that any kind of transition and the funding for it becomes more difficult the greater the flows of oil from the ground to the consumer. So right now, in fact, what I would say is we've had sort of an extension of what I call the big bonfire, that we're really burning this fossil fuel resource at an ever-increasing rate. It doesn't necessarily mean that catastrophe is around the corner at all. We do tend to respond to crises and price cycles and so on, but, you know, the way John just mentioned, but I would say that it is, after all, at the end game, a finite resource. Technology has the use of technology when prices grow has been able to increase flows, extract more oil from some formations. The shale oil being a resource that's most prominent to everyone right now. I mean, we found that resource. The Bakken was discovered in 1951, but it was uneconomical, and so it sat there. It was drilled a little bit here and there in the Williston Basin up in North Dakota, but we only produced it once we got the technology and the price set up right to make that flow to the consumer. So we're continuing the big bonfire through this 2 to 3, 3.5 million barrels. It's hard to say exactly how much it is coming from shale oil. I just don't think the rate of increase can be sustained much longer. I also am highly skeptical that within the next 5 years that there can be, perhaps 10 years out, there can be some shale oil pulled from the rest of the world. But I really want to emphasize the fact that this is a North American phenomenon, and our lenses, our rose-colored glasses here on this side of the Atlantic are very much impacted by what's happening in our own backyard. The world at large has not only not seen this, but they're having economic problems, and there are violence problems in the Middle East, kind of a high-crime neighborhood, if you will. We're in the middle of that. Sometimes at the cause of it, it's. I would say that the transition that we need to fund and enable going forward is going to be extremely difficult to achieve with our current mindset. And the don't worry, be happy mentality, thanks to the shale oil boom. So just at the personal level, I'll end my comment, the personal level, I drive a hybrid Prius. It gets electricity from the house. It gets, some electricity off the solar collectors on the roof. So I'm driving around with an alternative fuel. But the sales of that alternative type vehicle have dropped dramatically just because of price signals to consumers. And so it isn't just investors, John, that are having a hard time funding the alternatives. It's the consumers who aren't getting a consistent price signal that sends them towards the new technologies or new alternative fuels and so on that will enable that transition. So I think we're headed for some rocky shoals around the corner, next bend in the river. I don't know when it'll be here, and I don't know how painful, but it just looks like we, rather than it being forward-thinking, I think we're rather respond to crises, and we're just waiting for the next one.
Thank you, Steve. And Jeremy, we were speaking a little bit about this on break, and I'd love to, as someone who's been in the oil industry for so long, and oil has sort of brought so much wealth to the industrialized world, and it's resources that you may need to invest in this transition. So I guess I'm wondering, what does transition look like to you? What are the opportunities, and what are these other risks, including perhaps, for the oil industry, including perhaps climate change?
Well, I think different. There are huge differences between how energy users and energy producers see the future. If you look at the predictions that Exxon and BP make in their long-term production forecasts, I mean, they seem to be assuming, or they're estimating that oil demand and oil production will continue to increase for the next 20, 25 years. I wonder whether that really is the case, and I wonder whether in 25 years' time it'll be the conventional supply-demand, price-cost curves that drive production, or whether perhaps the Saudis are being a little bit cleverer than we sometimes give them credit, and whether what they're doing now in terms of keeping their production high but at low prices is to make sure they don't get stuck in 20, 25 years' time with what's sometimes been called stranded oil, that they're not put in the position where the world has come to its senses, and in order to address some of the causes of climate change, is restricting hydrocarbon production. And they could be left, in that sort of scenario, they could be left with large remaining reserves, still perhaps at that point hundreds of billions of barrels of reserves, which they're not allowed to produce. So they've taken the option, one might argue, of producing now at high rates, making certain that their fields are depleted 20, 25 years down the line. They may be selling that oil at low price, but at least they're avoiding the scenario where they're stuck with a large proportion of their potentially producible oil just stuck in the ground because they're not allowed to produce it. So I think we're looking at a changing world. People eventually are going to are going to understand what peak oil is all about. They're going to understand that production can't keep on at current levels forever. Whether that the turning point is 1 year's time or 20 years' time, we can argue about. But there's going to come a point where we cannot produce 100 million barrels a day, where production rates are going to go down. And we need to have, whether they go down because we force them down because we don't like what they're doing to our world, or whether they go down because there's not sufficient oil left to dry in the ground to drive them, is irrelevant. There's going to be a point where they start going down. And that's what we need to be preparing for. And that's what we quite clearly, in most countries around the world at this point, are not preparing for.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. And to quote Fleetwood Mac, I guess, don't stop thinking about tomorrow.
To quote, I don't know, was it Naimi or his predecessor who said the Stone Age didn't end because the world ran out of stones.
Right.
Exactly.
And we don't want to hit the oil age because we run out of oil. We want to, be off to something else well in advance. We try to stay neutral in all this, but I think that is sort of an underlying theme of this program, is that proactivity is we want to look at what is a prudent path. So we are at the end of our hour. Gentlemen, I thank you so much. I invite any parting thoughts that you may have before we close.
Well, my parting thought would be, we started off asking about what had changed in the last 10 years in relation to peak oil. And I'll end where I finished. Reservoir physics hasn't changed. We may see ways of producing a fixed resource more effectively, but the resource is fixed. It's not going to grow. So we need to live with that fact.
And I would say that's always been that case, but there have always been projections of the sort of imminent, not exhaustion of resources, but the imminent crisis coming down the road, going really back to Colonel Drake's first well, and just hasn't happened. I mean, a couple of times it got a little uncomfortable, and I certainly would say that back around 2006, 2007 was that time. But ultimately, the world figured out a way.
It'll continue to figure out ways, but some of those ways may cost more and may be less energy efficient, and so it may never actually be useful.
Yeah, I would end with the notion that on the way up the production curve of all resources, it's additive. Everything is additive. Hydropower, nuclear, natural gas, oil, and so on. We've had this wonderful long boom, century plus long boom of additive resources and the aggregate. And at some point, it's not that hard to predict. It's hard to predict when. It's impossible. But you can safely assume that at some point, you cannot keep adding, short of some enormous breakthrough like cold fusion or whatever. Given the known resources, energy resources you're working with today, you can't keep growing production forever. And we should be planning for the time after that, well in advance of when that time arrives.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. We've been talking about whatever happened to peak oil with John Kingston, president of the McGraw-Hill Financial Institute and the former news director for Platts, the Energy Information Unit of McGraw-Hill, Jeremy Gilbert, the former chief petroleum engineer for BP, and Steve Andrews, co-founder of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil. Gentlemen, thanks very much for your time and insights today.
Most welcome.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, and you can find out more information about the Energy Exchange and future podcasts at energyx.org. Thank you.